Okay.
Thank you, Cheryl. Okay, so this is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 30th of August, 2017. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis are the facilitators, and Craig McKee, who I believe is present, right, Craig? You here?
Yeah, I'm here. Yes.
Okay, he's our secretary. And we'll proceed with a request to approve the minutes from the previous teleconference, which were circulated by Craig. Anyone have any objections? Hearing none, the minutes were approved, and we'll move on to a review of tonight's agenda. The three items on the agenda. James, are you going to be able to present tonight?
Yeah, I believe so. I had to scroll backward a long way through about a million emails to find the information, the phone number and the code, but I found it, so here I am.
Huh, wow. That's tough when you got computer problems. I know, man. I've been through it so many times. Okay, thank you. So the proposal is then to include a short, excuse me, a short introduction by Richard of Richard Gage of what's going to be happening in September, events going on there, what's going on nationally and so forth. So if there's no objection, we'll give Richard a little bit of time at the beginning of our teleconference to address us with that, and then we'll proceed with the rest of the agenda as posted. Is there any objection to that, or does anybody have any amendment to the agenda?
Ken, can I just mention, I have no problem with that, of course. I was, I think as I discussed with you beforehand, there was a possibility that I might sort of get pulled away from the phone for about 10 minutes, probably closer to 9:30, that's what I'm hoping. But I'm just concerned about whether the order of the two things that I'm involved in, and whether it would be better to have the censorship thing.
Please make a proposal. Make a proposal to move something from one place to another place. That's the best way to do this, okay?
Okay. Well, then I'd like to move that the Google censorship item get moved up one in the agenda so that it would come after Wayne's.
I thought it did. Doesn't it?
Well, I didn't see it that way on the draft agenda unless I read it wrong.
Okay, well, if it's not that way, then if there's no objection, we'll take Craig's item.
I think it did come second. Yeah, I think it did come second.
Yeah, I believe it did.
Oh, did it? No, oh, did I read it wrong?
Yeah,
okay,
what actually comes second, Craig, is the is your and my proposal, okay?
Right, that's the one I was wanting to – I mean, I'm just thinking about if I'm going to get interrupted in the middle, it would be better to be interrupted in the middle of that one.
Would you like to put the proposal after Richard's address? Or maybe do you want to take it first? Do you want to take it first?
I'm confused.
Well, I'm confused about what it is that you're concerned about. So,
I was just trying to make sure that I didn't get interrupted in the middle of the Google thing. So I was suggesting moving it above the other proposal that I'm involved in, but you're telling me that it's already above.
I see. Okay, you want to reverse the order of the two of your two items.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
If there's no objection, then we'll take the proposal, the proposed guideline, and put it after Craig's presentation. Okay. So cool. That would be the current order of the agenda. If there's no objection, is there any objection? Hearing none, then we'll proceed with the agenda under those auspices, and our first person to speak then will be Richard Gage, who will tell us about what's coming up in September. Go ahead, Richard.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, everybody. We're kind of excited this year to be able to have a number of exciting activities, actually, starting with September 6th in Fairbanks, Alaska. President, the Professor Halsey, who has been engaged in a $300,000 two-year study of World Trade Center 7, doing this computer modeling, we'll have a presentation on the the actual draft report, which is coming out in October, but his findings, which will be summarized or detailed then. So in Fairbanks, he will be presenting on September 6th, and that will be live streamed. Kelly, do you know what time that is? I've forgotten.
No.
So the details will be on our website and a link to listen to the live stream. And our website is ae911truth.org. That's very exciting because we've been waiting a long time. And by the way, we still have about $100,000 of those fees to raise. So we'll be doing that. So don't get excited when we start asking for money and everybody gets all up in arms. But that's what it takes to put these kinds of efforts forward and really make things happen in the 9/11 truth movement. The next thing that's happening for us is a wonderful outdoor venue in Foley Square. Thank you to the graces of Barbara Honiger, who has rented the equipment and the chairs necessary, and Les Jamison getting the permitting necessary to have this event at 6:30 September 8th, Friday night. 7 blocks north of World Trade Center complex, a film festival featuring Barbara's walking tour of the 9/11 Museum. What you're really seeing when you look at that stuff and what you're not seeing. We'll be showing our film as well, Standing for Truth, with Peter Ketchum, this whistleblower. Ed Asner's narrated a beautiful 15-minute documentary of World Trade Center 7. And we will be introducing the Bobby McElvain Act, which calls upon Congress to initiate an investigation of World Trade Center, all three high-rises. This is an act modeled after the Benghazi Act for that investigation. And we are spending a lot of effort starting in Washington, D.C., to find the congressman, the needle in the haystack, who will introduce this legislation, who will stand up for truth. We have some decent leads. But we're asking everybody who's listening here to make an appointment with your congressman. You've been looking for an excuse to go in there with some new information when we have it. This act is something they need to be aware of. It is a way that they can stand for truth. And barring that, it is your imposition upon them of holding them accountable. And they need to be held accountable. And that's why we're delivering this package to every member of Congress, 539, starting at 3:30 on September 11th, and then on the 12th all day. Why are we starting at 3:30? Because before that, we have booked a room in the National Press Club, and we will have our press conference announcing the Bobby McElvain Act at 1 p.m. in the Zenger Room. So come and join us if you're nearby the Press Club, National Press Club, Washington, D.C. We then go over and begin the process of hand-delivering these packages, which include the 2,900 architects and engineers calling for a new investigation, which includes the progress report, which we'll have at that time, from Professor Holsey's study. And then we'll have other supporting materials as well, a letter from Bob McElvain. Bob McElvain himself will be at the press conference. Peter Ketchum will be there. I'll be there. We'll all be speaking. And then we come back in Arlington, Virginia, to a panel, which will include speakers on the subject of 9/11 truth, including Barry Kissin, including J. Michael Springman, visas for Al-Qaeda, and myself and others. So it's a very exciting series of events coming up here in September. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, keep them brief. If you have a question, just go ahead and shout it out.
Can we get this all down in writing or in an email so we can make some plans? It's very difficult
If you're not getting our emails, it's because you are not subscribed onto our email list or our petition. The easiest way to rectify that situation is to go to our website right now at ae911truth.org. Scroll to the bottom of the page, look for the email newsletter sign up, fill it out, click submit, and then you'll have to click submit again. And then when the authentication email comes back to you, look for it and click that link. That is how you get informed about everything we're doing. And on our website, these details will be present as well at ae911truth.org.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I just wondered, at 1 p.m. you said you're going to be at the National Press Club. And is that on September 11th?
That is on September 11th, Monday. National Press Club, 1 p.m., press conference.
Okay.
And there's another event that night elsewhere put on by DC 911 Truth. So those details will be at DC 911 Truth.
Great.
Richard, regarding the September 6th podcast, or I'm sorry, live stream, did you get the time on that? What time that's going to be?
I don't have it, and Kelly doesn't have it.
No, not yet.
It'll be on our website.
What?
Would you email that information to Craig when you get it so that he can put it into the minutes, please? In case we get the minutes out before then.
Sure.
Thank you.
The thing at Arlington, Virginia is also listed on Eventbrite, so you can go to Eventbrite and sign up for that. Over.
Thank you.
Great. And there's a link also on DC911truth.org, right, John? That's still there.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Voice again, John.
So it sounds like we've got a lot to look forward to in September, and thanks to AE911 Truth, as always, for all the good work they're doing, and let's be prepared to help them out with their need for supporting the research that's probably going to be pretty vital in convincing the American people that there's a scientific basis for 911 Truth. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys. I'll be
all
right here listening to the rest.
Okay, so now it's time to move on to our first presentation tonight. And for this presentation, this is our first experiment in what's called online meeting. And if you tried to get to the URL and you were unsuccessful, here's why. Apparently, there's an extra HTTP colon or something in front of the second HTTP that needs to be removed in order for that code to work. So if you want to try it again, and those of you that are at your computers and you want to be able to watch the slides as they're presented by Wayne, okay, it's a very easy process, but unfortunately, I guess the URL got scrambled in the process. So just remove the first HTTP whatever from the address bar, and you'll get there. And
so Ken, that's not there's also a it needs to be an https://. The colon's missing on the second one. So, but actually, if you get rid of everything when you click on it, if you just have join dot. Free conference call, blah 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 blah. It'll resolve everything. So just use the join from join on, and it all should work. Over.
I'm sorry, this is getting over my head. Okay, so anybody that's trying it and is having difficulty, please. Please report back in so we can see what we can do to make sure that everybody who wants to be part of this gets there.
Can they also go to hopeoutloud.org/pentagon/exit?
No.
No.
Oh,
okay.
You can go there and you can download, you can view the PDF online, and it's the what's it called? The photographic review of the exit hole at the Pentagon. you can go there also, hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon.
Yeah, the URL for the for the PDF is still good. You can, anybody can download that and or just open it up and watch do your own scrolling. But for the convenience of staying with the presenter, it's much easier to watch the slides as they're being presented. So if anybody's having trouble getting on, let me know. But we'll just wait another minute, and then we'll get started with Wayne's presentation. For those that made it onto the, let's see how many we've got. Oh, we've got, I guess, sure, no. Well.
What are you looking at, Ken?
I'm looking at the attendee list that's showing up from the online meeting, but it doesn't make clear whether the people are on just the phone or whether they're plugged in up here. So I don't.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. Know.
Yeah. Is anybody on the call connected to our online meeting?
Yes.
Who?
This is Frank. I'm on my cell phone, and I also have my computer in front of me. I was able to get into the photographic review of the exit hall.
Good. Okay, so do you see a PIN number showing you? Is it showing you a PIN number there for yourself?
9644.
Yeah, okay. So if you will dial into your phone, #9644, it will align you with your phone, okay? It will show that you're the same person.
Right.
Yeah, I just want to see what that would be, if you don't mind, okay?
Right.
But it's going to be probably a different PIN for everybody, so don't everybody else do that. It will give you a unique PIN code.
Well, Ken, because Craig's got to has a line and some things to do, I think maybe we should probably just get going.
Yeah, let's keep going.
You can download. You can download and view the entire PDF by going to hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon, and it should be the second link down, exit hall. So there's been a lot of discussion in the past about what the C-Ring exit hall actually was, how it might have been formed. In the past, there's been some discussion about how the columns were such an impediment that there's no way things could go in, and we've heard people say, well, there's been a slurry that goes in and around the columns. I was never very comfortable with that, even though they were said by some of the large plane impact proponents. So earlier this year, I got interested in the question of was that accurate? And I went and actually took a close look at how things were done. And I'm going to go through some of this information here. I look at a lot of pictures of the inside of the Pentagon as it's being cleaned up and things like that. So I ran across some photographs that are very intriguing, and we'll kind of go through those. And ultimately, it shows that there were some clear paths for debris from the E-ring exit, from the E-ring entrance hole to the C-ring exit hole. And so let me kind of go through that again. If you don't have the slides, this is never going to work as well. So going on to slide, things don't work always easy. Slide two is orientation. Slide three is an overview that many of us have seen before, but it provides some landscapes. First of all, what we see here are the five rings. I want to point out that there are two-story sections between rings E and D, between D and C, and then it goes all the way down to ground level between C and B, and then there's another, as you can see, just three rows of windows in the A and B section. The impact area is where the roof had collapsed over the area from around column 18AA to column 8AA in wedge 1. The C-ring exit hole is between columns 5O and 7O in wedge 2. Wedge 2, of course, was not the reconstructed version, and you might happen to notice that the windows in the A&E drive to the left of the A&E drive are intact, while many of the ones to the right are not. That's because they weren't upgraded ones. Moving on to slide 4, this is a picture of the from the ASCE report that shows the columns. The columns, in this case, were highlighted with colors to show their damage. They were, in fact, shown not to scale, but they were about three times larger than, a little bigger than three times larger in each direction. So almost 10 times bigger area-wise than they existed in reality. I've also highlighted the two-story sections because so many people kind of get confused about the fact that the first two floors were continuous open space with the exception of the columns from the E-ring to the C-ring. Going down to slide 5, this is kind of the takeaway point. If you do a graphical analysis of the spaces between the columns, we see that there are three, at least three, areas that go from the E-ring impact point to the C-ring exit hole. One is 1.1 feet, not very wide. Another one's 2.5 feet, and another one's 2.3 feet. So where I'm pointing by the 2.3 feet, we're going to do a little bit of measurements just to kind of see how things look. There's some photos from the inside looking at the C-ring exit hole that will give us some dimensions. So moving on to slide 7, we see kind of a zoom in of this area. I've identified columns 3N north, 3M north on the right-hand side, column 5N north on the left, and the angle of the photograph, and I've highlighted where wedge 1 and wedge 2 is. Slide 8 shows shows the exit hole from the inside looking between columns 3M and 3N, and you can see 5N on the left-hand side. Kind of moving on, slide 9 is a kind of a close-up. You can kind of look out through the window or through the opening to see some of the people, some of the workers there. Slide 10 is a different view of this that was done after the cleanup had progressed for a while. Going on to slide 12, I give some of the way that I'm going to validate the path width from these inside photos. I don't think I need to go over this, but if I go to a slide, I'm going to go to slide 14, which shows the view of the camera between the columns, and it's estimated that at that point there, what you can see is about 6.3 feet, and we're going to take a look at that going on to slide 15, where I superimpose the about a 6.3 foot distance. The column faces are 21 inches on a side. The wheelbarrow is about 21 inches, something like that. So it gives you some confidence that the drawings that I made that show the 2.5, the 2.3 foot, and the 1.1 foot are at least reasonable estimates. Now we're going to go take a look at the exit hole photos in the A&E, which is slide 17. I'm going to go through these fairly quickly. Slide 17 is an early photo with some smoke rising from the exit hole. Slide 18 is one of the more recently released FBI photos. Again, it shows the debris, probably September 12th. Slide 19 is from the Massawi trial, I believe. Again, you can see the debris. We're going to zoom in on a couple of pieces. Slide 20 shows the interior plaster wall mesh was not really destroyed on the inside. You know, there's an argument that there was shape charges, but the interior wall was still kind of like hanging there, the plaster and what appears to be metal last. And again, some more of the debris. We'll talk about that. Go to slide 21. Now, the next couple of slides are going to try to focus in on some of the debris that is identifiable that people have talked about. And here what we have is the wheel. I've kind of cut out and enlarged the section that shows a tire that's pretty well damaged and separated from the hub, which is we'll see in some of the other photos from different angles. So slide 22 is a photo again from that angle. You can again also see the tire. These are none of these are good photos, but they are very indicative of a tire and some of the other pieces, especially the wheel hub, and I believe some of the landing gear is attached to that. Slide 23 is from a video called Inside the Pentagon, and the video is not very good on YouTube, and so you can see the tire on the right-hand side. This is just one of the screen captures in the wheel rim. Slides 24, 25, and 26 basically show that some of the quotes at the mouth of the third hole, they saw a piece of a wheel and countless shards of wreckage. Slide 25, I looked left and saw a huge hole in what looked like a piece of the landing gear. The wheel and the piece of landing gear, about 10 feet of landing gear, had just sheared off and punched a huge hole. This is from the firefighters. There's some more text here if you want to read it. I don't need to go through it word for word. I've highlighted some of the key phrases. Going to slide 28, we start talking about the wall that was broken in the C-ring exit hole area. The AEC report says the first floor story at the AE drive is brick infill with concrete frame with no windows. The columns on either side of the C-ring exit hole are about 20 feet apart, and there's no significant intermediate support observed between the columns. They're about 10 feet high, and it's between columns 5-0 and 7-0 in the wedge 2. So you've got a large wall, infill brick, and in fact, it's only two bricks thick. Slide 29, we're going to see a number of these. Slide 29 shows a close-up near the plaster and wire lath, showing the two layers of bricks on the of the wall. Slide 30 is from a different angle. Also note that there's a pipe bent outwards. There's a number of things that are actually bent in the initial photos before they started using it as a door, bent outwards. And again, the wall appears to substantiate the other picture, which had two bricks thick. Slide 31, zoom in. Again, two bricks thick. Can't see anything thicker or more substantial. Slide 32, just another one, two bricks thick is all you can see. And then a couple of other slides here. Slide 34 is looking from the C-ring back through to the E-ring windows. Originally, I thought that the internal work lights thing marked as internal work light was actually seeing through the forest, the columns, but there, at this stage, there's so much cribbing to hold up the upper floors that there's no light, and this is an internal light. But if you look to the right, you can see the E-ring windows, and again, that shows that there is, in fact, no intervening walls of any substance between the rings on this on the first floor that you can see here. Slide 35 is kind of another photo, and I kind of zoomed in on the window area. Slides 37 and 38 are just simply other versions of the floor plans showing the columns to scale. And they are far smaller than those that's shown in the ASCE report, which was done for, they were made bigger so you could see the colors. And that concludes the presentation, and I hope I stayed within my 15 minutes. Looks like I did. Okay? Any questions?
Yep.
Thank you for being concise. We get time for a couple short questions, so who would like to ask a question or make a comment?
This is Cheryl. I'd like to ask a question, Wayne. The pictures, it looks like the plane would have to have been sliding along the ground, have gone through that, and I'm just wondering if an aluminum plane going that fast wouldn't rip apart before it could make that hole in the C-ring.
Well, the entire plane it would have been torn up by going through the columns, and then there are, of course, many other columns by the time you get close to the C-ring that are just damaged. They are still intact. And so whatever had to fly through the openings had to go in a straight line, which is why, you know, I keep getting challenged on so many of these questions. So I had to see if there was a way that something of mass, significant mass, and especially the wheel and the landing gear pieces could actually have gone through. Because there's no way that they could have gone, floated around in a slurry or in and out of the columns. No, to do this. They never could have done that. But the fact that there are these 2 foot wide paths for something to have gone through substantiates that the presence of some of this material, some of the big pieces. What you're seeing is not the whole plane, but some of the heavier pieces that made it through this these corridors between the columns, the paths between the columns that I've graphically produced, and I believe that they're accurate. I didn't include the columns near the E-ring impact point, simply because the columns there were all destroyed or knocked down or something, so they would not have been an impediment. And we were just looking for, are there pathways to go from the E-ring entrance point to the C-ring exit hole? And in fact, subject to being corrected, and someone doing a better job than I did and showing you that there's no way, I don't think that's likely. I think I've done a good job on this, so there's a pathway.
But when I look at your photo in slide 3, it looks like the angle would be totally off, that it couldn't actually go through the E-ring entrance hole and come out the C-ring exit hole, like a part of the building would still be in the way that's standing right at the E-ring entrance. So to me, that doesn't look like it would work.
What are you pointing at the
E-ring entrance hole, if you look at an angle toward the C-ring exit hole there, it just looks like it couldn't work. There's part of the building in blocking the E-ring entrance there to have a great angle to hit the C-ring exit hole that you have there. It just doesn't look visually like that would work.
Right. So great question, Cheryl. I'm glad you asked it so I can emphasize again. At the first two floors, floors 1 and 2, are open, and there are no walls there at all. There's the outer E-ring wall that we've talked about, and there's the C-ring, and those are the only walls that exist between that. And, for example, if you were to go to slide 4, you'll see that they are, in fact, two-story sections between the E-ring and the D and the C-ring. They're 2 stories tall, so there's no impediments, which is why I show those last slides at the very end.
I don't understand that, Wayne. I don't understand what you mean. There's 2 stories high, and so there's no impediment. I don't get what you're saying there.
Okay, right. So if you go back to loose change and plain sight, all these other early videos, what they said, and I've even heard some of our more contemporary experts, so to speak, talking about this, where they say the plane has to go hit the E-ring, go out the E-ring through a wall, into the D-ring through a wall, out of the D-ring, into the C-ring, and then out of the C-ring. And so there's all these walls in plain sight. Says there's 9 feet of reinforced steel, steel reinforced concrete in the way, and in fact there's none. There's the outer wall, which isn't even concrete. It's just some infill bricks and the frames for the windows, and there's nothing. There are no walls in there.
I see, Wayne, that's why I'm confused. I see walls. I see the D-ring with two walls. I see the C-ring with two walls. I don't get what you're saying.
Because those are the floors 3, 4, and 5. Floors 1 and 2, one is where all the vast amount of damage was, doesn't have a wall that goes all the way down. That's why on slide 3, I put in the little boxes that say two-story section between E and D, and two-story section between D and C, because they're two stories. That means the first two stories are continuous. There are no walls.
So what is there? What is there? Then a facade on the first two floors, or what?
No, nothing. That's why if you go to, I think it was my slide 39, where you look back from the C-ring exit hole and you look out through the window in the E-ring, and I kind of zoomed in and blew it up. There's nothing between them. There's no interior walls. That's a misconception that goes back.
No, interior walls. Yes. I think the problem here is that Cheryl's talking about exterior walls, okay, and you're talking about interior walls.
Right. I think Cheryl has to be talking about the interior walls because we know that the plane impacted.
I'm talking about all the walls, Wayne. But I just don't get what you're saying. But that's okay. Don't let me keep everyone listening. Just go on and I'll.
Well, it's an important thing because it's the first two floors are continuous, no walls between them from the outer E ring to the inner C ring. There's no walls in between. Only these 21-inch square columns.
So, that's Kelly, so you're saying from the E-ring all the way to the C-ring, there are no walls?
From the E-ring to the C-ring, there are no internal solid walls other than partitions. And there's vast number of pictures showing the aluminum studs and drywall that have been damaged, not particularly in that area, but all around the Pentagon.
But in your opinion, there are no interior walls.
Pardon?
Okay. So in your opinion, the plane itself went through that without a problem?
There are large pieces, such as the landing gear and the wheel, that made it through. That's all I can say. Plus, there's many other shards of stuff that flowed through this also. And if you read the interviews with people inside the building, they'll talk about the huge winds and the winds as the fireball on the outside blew things through the building.
Would a bomb create the same effect?
No. Many of the people, for example, will talk about the winds, and they will. One woman talked about seeing a chalkboard sliding, something happening at the far end of the room, and a chalkboard sliding at her. She puts her hands up to try to hold it. So it's a. It's very much. If you do what I've done and read through many of these accounts. You hear a lot about winds. Of course, there's people that say explosions that blew up, but in fact, what you hear is consistent with an impact followed by a fireball type pressure event that blew things through. That's why people talk about the winds. So, it's a.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
What about all the other witnesses that said they smelled cordite, which is an explosive?
So many of those people, as you probably recall, Frank, say that they were in the A ring and the C ring. I don't recall that there are other people in the C, D, and E rings saying the same thing.
Well, April Gallup said that.
Yeah, and no, even if they were... And even
hang
if they
a
were, what difference would that make, being that they were that far apart? I mean, they obviously smelled it, so it existed. Am I wrong?
Yes. The A and B rings are completely separated from the B, C, and D rings.
So there could have been an explosion in those rings, you're saying, but not in the others?
Separate? My understanding of many of the witnesses that Barbara Honegger has pulled together talk about the cordite, and they talk about the A and the B ring, which are far from where the plane impact was. April Gallup does not talk about anything to do, at least than anything I've seen, does not talk about anything to do with the smell of cordite.
I think she does. I think I've heard her say that.
I do. Oh, I do as well. I actually just recently read her testimony, and she did. So, regardless.
April Gallup there are other people who in the days and weeks after talk about helping her out, and they don't talk about going through the entrance hole, so to speak. And of course, that entrance hole is fully engulfed in flames in the photographs that you see. There's the tree that's burning, the remnants of the tree, column 16. For some to actually have gone into this fire area, they would not have come out. They would have had to go the other direction.
So in your opinion, it's possible that there was explosives used at some point somewhere.
I'm only talking about there could have been explosives, certainly. I have no idea what happened in the A and B rings. What I've been talking about is that the evidence for a large plane that had impacted the building and done the damage is once you look at it, it's irrefutable. And
Where's the luggage, Wayne?
Well, the luggage is all inside. There's a huge
passengers
a huge
or the
We're out of time on this on this issue, unless people want to vote to extend it, which means extending the total time of the teleconference. I think we should kind of leave it there, because this is a very controversial question. It could go on and on, and I know it would. So let's just leave it there and thank Wayne for another cogent presentation, and we'll move on to Craig's issue.
Okay.
Thank you, Wayne. Wayne's presentation. Craig's presentation. Craig is going to speak about the recent spate of censorship from Google. Go ahead, Craig.
Listen, I have a small problem. That little time where I was going to be pulled away from the phone came a little earlier than I thought, but it's only going to be probably 5 minutes or so. So I don't know if you want to
We can ask James to do his issue.
That'd be awesome.
Get you when you come back, okay? When you come back, will you be back for good, or do you know?
I'll let you know.
Okay. All right. So if there's no objection, then we'll just let James give us another one of his scintillating book reviews. Are you ready, James?
Well, I don't know how scintillating. Depends on whether I can read my notes there, but we'll have a go. I read recently and have reviewed a book by Roberto Quaglia, The Myth of September 11th, The Satanic Verses of Western Democracy. And I'd like to know first, how many of you have any familiarity with this book? Anybody have read it or read about it or know anything about it? Well, you know, I discovered this almost by accident, and it really, really startled me because because I would take it as one of the very best sources of not only information but discussion of 9/11 that's in print. It's a major work. I read the second English edition. He published a number of editions beginning in Italian and then German and Romanian, and before he got French, I believe, before he got to an English edition out, first in 2011, updated from all the earlier editions in 2015, but it's 617 pages. And I would count it as the most difficult single author book I've ever read to sum up, but at the same time the most interesting nonfiction book by a single author that I've read as far back as I can remember. Roberto Quaglia is a brilliant Italian by his own pegging, a science fiction author. He's an absolute polymath. He's seemingly knows all or most of international literature, avant-garde science, films, especially of the dystopian or futuristic flavor, philosophy, mystery fiction, and Cold War and post-Cold War history, and also quotations. He's got fantastic quotations from everybody you've heard of and everybody you haven't heard of, and they're very helpful and interesting. He has a wonderful, or terrible, depending on how you look at it, sense of dry gallows humor and comic understatement. He thoroughly analyzes every conceivable, and I mean every conceivable aspect of the 9/11 operation and events, and especially their reportage. And several years, including several years of the aftermath of all that, the motive or point, the entire point of 9/11, he says, is the production of the epic film shown and sold universally, which he calls America Under Attack. That's the whole point. That's the only reason that 9/11 happened was to produce and circulate that film universally for the purpose. Let's see, I got lost my own notes here. The only set of candidates for the role of perpetrator, let's see, where are we? Are those who gained from the operation, and for the purpose being to restrict liberties of citizens and also to invade the Middle East to extract scarce and dwindling resources. And the sequel of that film, of that fantastic film, really fantastic film, America Under Attack, he says sort of a spin-off of it being the Arab terrorists, and it's also, of course, fiction. And he says that nowadays human beings in the West live in perfect symbiosis with the mass media, and most concepts that live in people have to do with they are actually have been hand selected, filtered, selected, rumored, trivialized, and prefabricated by Big Brother, capital B, capital B. And he says there's more than one Big Brother, but they are all part of the same gang. he talks about what he calls weapons of mass banalization that were thus used. I think that's his own term. Unlike weapons of mass distraction, these weapons of mass banalization are strategic instruments, and if operated effectively, they have a long-lasting, almost irreversible effect. And their purpose is to insert in people's mind highly simplified and highly trivialized, hyper-simplified and highly trivialized versions of all the important events which happen or could in future happen around them, around the people, around everybody, actually. He demonstrates at length that instead of authentically living our life, we are therefore grotesquely living living theaters most of the events we experience by replacing them by the surrogate corresponding to the most adequate TV cliche. And even if we don't watch TV, we're surrounded and inundated by these cliches, and so that becomes our reality instead of experiencing reality, the events as they actually happen. We don't have any avenue for that. that's while the central meaning of 9/11 was the product of the film America Under Attack, which makes it the greatest show ever to be staged by a television or film producer, and most likely realize and understand why by now. Okay, I'm going to read a little bit from the section from the book, just a page or so. Let's see, I'm on page 'Til I'm in church trying to get the right hymn page. Okay. Let's see. Okay, we have discovered, he says, that the present-day world has no reason to envy the scenarios of science fiction literature. If the events which have taken place since September 11th had previously been used in the techno-thriller, no one would have bet a penny that such a far-fetched plot could one day become reality. In fact, the scope of the mystification to which the world was subjected by the diabolical creators who concocted these scenarios is so immense that even today the majority of the world's population cannot believe this is possible. even though its validity is fully demonstrable. Submerged is a huge bubble of hallucinatory unreality, not unlike the worst literary nightmares born from Philip K. Dick's brilliant and paranoid mind. The world is no longer credible in its real term for those who get to live in it. On its journey toward the strange and incredible, reality has outdone itself. We suspected it could do so. We knew it would surprise us, but we never imagined to what extent, he says. He analyzes accordingly the follow-up events as well, very, very, almost exhaustively and exhaustingly, thoroughly, as they become stranger and stranger, as we all know, more surreal, to use his words, which I think is very apt, up to the time of the latest of his multiple editions, which he does a pretty fair job, not perfect, but pretty fair job of coordinating and updating until the edition that I read in published in 2015. So the fact that he began writing this and publishing it back in 2003 shouldn't put anybody off. You won't feel like you're reading something passé. You're really not. I was going to read one more thing right at the very end of the book on page 614. Inevitably, he says, any book which tackles the September 11th event is confined in good or bad faith to a branch of that same tree of myths. And, of course, all we have is myths, according to him, and I think he makes his case, and is partially divergent from other books on the same subject, which is something that takes away from the credibility of all of them. It becomes obvious now that no book can tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, about what really happened on September 11th in America. We have the myth according to which Bush and his alleged business partner Osama organized the attack. We have the myth that Bush was partially or totally unaware, and that the whole plot was hatched by his vice president, Dick Cheney. We have the myth that the Bush administration is the scapegoat of a plot schemed by the CIA. We have the myth that the CIA is nothing but the material executive of the will of the military-industrial complex. We have the myth that the CIA is completely innocent and that everything was plotted by the Pentagon in league with the White House. We have the myth that the plan is instead entirely the result of the notorious neocons. We have the myth that the neocons are merely a tool and probably the scapegoat for a much bigger and more complex operation. And we even have the myth that this conspiracy is the result of an invasion which occurred several thousand years ago by some reptilian aliens which seem to have merged their DNA with that of the ruling classes of the earth in order to enslave the rest of mankind. And the most extraordinary and fascinating thing is that this latter incredible myth is gathering more and more followers. The jungle of conflicting myth becomes inextricably dense, and the more you enter the microcosm of the details, and we can really assume that this didn't just happen by accident, but that there is a precise plan behind everything. The result is a babble of conspiracy theories that accuse each other of being either delusional myths or disinformation tools. Does any of that sound familiar? Anyway, I highly urge you to get and read this book. It's available on Amazon. It'll set you back a little bit, but it's very well worth it, and you'll read aspects and insights into aspects that you never dreamed of. I've only really touched on the full content. So any questions or comments?
Okay. Anybody besides me have a comment or a question?
This is Mike.
Mike here.
Who?
Can I speak?
Who?
Frank here.
Frank, go ahead.
Okay. I'm looking at it is available on Amazon. You said 626 pages.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if people will suffer from MEGO, my eyes glaze over. And who would you recommend getting this book to? I mean, obviously, I'm going to order a copy. It sounds interesting. Mm-hmm. But is this for newbies? Is this for people that already know something about politics or are familiar with 9/11? What do you think the best person to give this book to is? Who's that?
To give the book to?
Yeah, in other words, what do you think the prospective audience for this book is?
Oh, I think anybody that's interested in the, what would we say, my words fail me, the sort of meta meaning of 9/11. And anybody that's interested in a extremely thorough investigation of the events. There are just things that we all know about various pieces of what we call the evidence and the breakdown of the events that he finds meanings and once you read what they are, very obvious aspects of that we probably never thought of or never would think of, but we are very much instructed by what he has seen. He's just very good at seeing the depths of things and the fine details. It's sort of like looking at reality through a extremely extremely powerful microscope. But you won't get tired of reading it. It's very entertaining. Actually, I didn't. I read it in about 2 weeks. Just so much a day, and didn't have any trouble getting through. There was no point where I considered quitting at all. And you'll be glad you got it and read it. It'll make you think for sure.
Okay. Anybody else?
So a quick question. You've mentioned a couple of times a video in your review called America Under Attack. What is that about? Is that about?
Well, I think there's a documentary called that he refers to. But what he's talking about under that title is that the sole purpose, the sole real purpose of having the event happen at, or the events, plural, happen at all on 9/11 was the making of this film, the production of the and film and circulating that universally to the world audience, especially Americans.
So just to be clear, there's not a video that you're that he's talking about called
No.
It is a metaphysical description of the entire 9/11 event.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
Like a meme. Okay.
If you go back to the title, you can kind of picked that up, the myth of September 11th, and then the subtitle, The Satanic Verses of Western Democracy. You know.
Does anybody else have a question or a comment?
This is Cheryl. I just wanted to thank James for introducing us to the book. I'd never heard of it, and so
it's amazing that it's remained, to make a fun undercover.
Okay. This is Ken. I'd like to just comment that as you were giving the review, I could not help but be reminded over and over again of society of spectacle, okay? That seems to be the underlying motif here, even though he goes into much greater detail, of course. Mm-hmm. But that particular work just finds out as the guiding principle that he's adumbrating here. But how much exactly does the book cost?
Oh, let's see. I think it cost me, I believe, $20 plus shipping and handling.
I'm on Amazon right now. It's $24 on Amazon.
Yeah.
How much?
$24. I have it up on Amazon.
$24 now. Yeah, 24. I don't know if there are any used copies available or not. Okay. I believe it's on eBay, too. You might be able to pick up a less expensive copy there, which I may have done. I don't recall. But
okay.
It's available, I believe, either place. And remember, you'll be getting your money's worth. It's over 600 pages.
It's only $9 if you want to put it on your Kindle.
Only how much?
I think it's $9 if you want to put it on Kindle.
Cool. Thank you. Thank you for that information. Okay, well, that keeps it affordable for folks that have a limited budget like me.
Well, that's right. Well, this displaced several others, I'll have to say, for me. I would be interested in a follow-up in a later meeting to see what people have to say after they've had a chance to spend some time with the book.
Well, let's see if that happens. If enough people read the book and have an interest, certainly that could be proposed, and we could have a little online discussion about the book,
That would be very apt. I'm sure it would be lively.
Okie doke. James, thanks once again for, as I think I was correct, your scintillating review of
I probably have to make a couple other comments. First of all, I had to apologize that I didn't get my notes are on one giant note card, and it's written so small that I have trouble following my own writing, and I never realize how hard it is until it comes time to reread it. And the other thing is the question that I'm surprised nobody thought to ask is, what did he have to say about Israel or Jews or something like that being involved? And he made a reference in one single paragraph, which I don't know if it lets him off the hook or not. You'll have to decide. And that is that he didn't have enough information on the subject, and that's the only reason he didn't really include it. But
I don't think I'd give him a pass for that, but anyway.
I wasn't sure I did.
Okay. So thank you again, James, and we look forward to more of these book reviews from you in the future, because you keep us up to date with what's really happening out there in the literary world regarding 9/11, and we appreciate it.
Well, I'll do what I can.
Thank you. Okay, I think Craig's back on the call. So, Craig, that means it's time for your presentation.
And okay, great.
Yep.
Thank you, everybody, for accommodating my little thing there. Appreciate it. Thank you, James. When I first heard back in April that Google was changing its algorithm, supposedly to combat fake news, I got very concerned because I sort of had a feeling I knew what the implications of that might be. In fact, I had a debate with somebody at a party on I happen to remember the date. It was April 29th, where the person was saying, "Well, if we lose a few good sites, as long as we get rid of this, you know, scourge of fake news, so if there's a few casualties, then, it's worth it." Which, of course, I didn't buy. I tried to explain to the person that an algorithm can't tell you what is true and what's not true. At best, it can only tell you what's deviating from the mainstream. And if one's purpose is to challenge purportedly credible mainstream news sources, then how exactly can those same mainstream sources be the standard that you measure yourself against? And, of course, what ended up happening was just as bad as I had kind of feared it would be. My own traffic, I'll just mention a bit about that, on my website, just Truth and Shadows, the traffic has dropped significantly. In May, I had 20,000 hits, which last year I averaged double that in 2016. In April, I had 63,000 hits. It was a particularly good month, and it dropped to 20,000. And my hits for August are around 14,000. And in the month is just about over, so it's been quite noticeable. And the idea, of course, if anybody hasn't been reading about it, is that Google has changed its algorithm to supposedly reduce the visibility of fake news stories, and specifically, reading here something from their own guidelines, which anyone can read, and I could include that in a minute. There are two, in particular, there are two types of web pages that Google considers problematic. And I'll just read what they've read here. Pages that directly contradict well-established scientific or medical consensus for queries seeking scientific or medical information, unless the query indicates the user is seeking an alternative viewpoint. So in other words, if you have to put something in your search terms that indicates that you don't want just the mainstream results. But of course, most people don't do that. The other one is pages that directly contradict well-established historical facts. And as you can imagine sort of what that suggests. Unsubstantiated conspiracy theories, as an example they give, unless the query, again, indicates the user is seeking an alternative viewpoint. So what the result of this, with other sites, since this began to happen, there have been a number of well-known sites. I mean, the ones that I have sort of got some figures on tend to be more on the, I guess some would put it, the sort of the progressive left type of sites, but I understand that there are conservative sites that are experiencing similar kinds of problems. But just to give a couple of examples, one, Global Research, which many people on the call would not only be familiar with, but would look at regularly, has reported a drop of 62% in its traffic. And there's other ones like Common Dreams, 37%, Democracy Now, 36%, Counterpunch, 21%, and other ones that have reported, I don't have specific numbers to go with, but WikiLeaks, The Intercept, the ACLU, Common Dreams, and Antiwar.com are among those as well. And one site that's really sort of written a lot about it is the World Socialist website. They report a drop of 2/3 in their traffic, and they're certainly very vocal and leading the charge, or one of the charges to fight this. Just to jump back to my own site for a second there, just to give you an example, my average hits per day in 2016 was 1,329, and my average for August was 504. Mm. So you can see that it's not an inconsiderable effect. And there are all kinds of, there's this thing called the First Draft Coalition, which is a coalition of basically mainstream entities that are basically trying to, I don't know all the details of exactly what they do, but they're obviously trying to allegedly stamp out unreliable information. That's something that's sponsored by Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, and others. Also, the Anti-Defamation League has been collaborating with YouTube in identifying, in quotes, extremists. The Anti-Defamation League, it has been cooperating with YouTube in getting extremist videos, they call it extremist, removed from YouTube. And Google's also a member of the ADL's Silicon Valley Anti-Cyber Hate Working Group. That's a mouthful. They have a document that they've written called Best Practices, which has been endorsed by Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all about addressing what they call hateful content. But I think you can imagine what type of content that they're talking about. YouTube has been really going after, which is owned by Facebook, or owned by Google, I'm sorry. I just get mixed up. Owned by Google. There are alternative news outlets that are being hit hard because they're having advertising removed from their videos. And this, Luke Rutkowski is one of the people that's reported this, and also Dan Dix from Press for Truth. So it's not just Google. The bottom line here is that it's not that Google and YouTube are erasing all this conspiracy research from the Internet, but they're doing everything possible to bury it so that only the most motivated consumers will find it. In other words, people who are already favorably disposed to the content, the chances of others coming across content that might lead them to depart from a mainstream view is becoming smaller and smaller. So that brings us to what we can do about that, and I'm hoping that there might be some ideas on the call here tonight. One thing we can certainly do ourselves is try to find any way to avoid using Google, to use other search engines that are not doing things the way Google's doing them. The problem is, of course, that it's not so much us using the search engine that's going to address this. It's the fact that everybody else has to use them as well, because most people use Google. I mean, 90-whatever percent. Are using Google. So if they're not finding this information, it doesn't really matter whether 9/11 truthers are using other search engines. I guess that's whipped over that fairly quickly. I'll finish reading this quote. I wrote this down. It's the guy, the International Editorial Board chairperson from the World Socialist website said, Google's claim that it is protecting readers from fake news is a politically motivated lie.
Yeah.
Google, a massive monopoly with the closest ties to the state and intelligence agencies, is blocking access to the World Socialist website and other left and progressive websites through a system of rigged searches. That's pretty much the overview that I've got. I'm certainly not an expert on algorithms and this sort of thing, so I'm not sure if I will have all the information that people might be looking for, but let's give it a try.
Yeah.
Can I say something? This is Cheryl.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cheryl.
I went to one of those you mentioned earlier, the World Socialist thing. They recommended some other websites, and one was DuckDuckGo. And go ahead.
This is Ken. I wanted to comment on that too, because I've been experimenting with DuckDuckGo for several weeks now, and I found their results reasonable. And they're not.
And the reason that I like them is they keep sending me something telling me that even if you switch to another search engine, that Google, because you've used them before, still kind of can grab your stuff, or I wasn't quite sure what they were saying, but so they have a way of, you can also like just cut that out so that Google can't get at you've already done with them or something like that. I don't know if you got that off.
I didn't understand what you said there.
I'm not saying it very well because I don't totally understand it, but there's something that even if you switch search engines because you used Google before, that they have some kind of access to something, stuff on your computer and places you've gone or that you may go, somehow they can still access it. So DuckDuckGo has some way that you can erase that or disconnect it so that Google can't get at it once you switch.
Yes, well, actually, I think, if I'm not mistaken, those are settings within your own Google account. And you can give them permission to get that information or deny it to Google. I believe that's everybody's prerogative.
Okay. Well, I'll send around the email they sent to me. That's probably not explaining it well anyway. But
I have to say it's not really that much of a transition to go from Google to DuckDuckGo. I mean, you're just getting results, but hopefully not getting them under Google's under any kind of repressive algorithm, although I do believe that they include Google among their engines that they access, but it's only one of several. Okay.
How do you spell that?
DuckDuckGo.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I have a couple of comments and maybe a couple of questions. One is that I've experienced this on my website, 911grassroots.org, that for last month had an all-time high of hits of nearly 80,000, just a hair under 80,000, or approaching 2,500 a day. And of course, this month it's going to be way down because my computer's been down for a week and I haven't posted anything. But I was having trouble. I wasn't getting even 2,000 most days. Well below that, some days as low as 1,200 hits, instead of the average approaching 2,500. And then I was thinking, if you left Google entirely as a home, wouldn't your numbers go down anyway because the other carriers would be less available and less visible? It seems like you'd be self-reducing to an extent that way, and wouldn't really, the net effect wouldn't really necessarily be good.
Well, let me jump in as Craig again. I don't know that anybody's talking about removing one's self from Google. I mean, any website can be found through Google, right? Yeah. The question is, how do we get not only use an alternative ourselves, but get other people to look for information on other search engines. But we don't want to stop people from finding us on Google. I mean, it's
right.
You know, I mean, let me just, I meant to mention this before, but just to give you an example, I did a little experiment. You know, I had this article that I wrote in 2010 with the headline, "How We Know a Large Plane Didn't Hit the Pentagon." That steadily built over time to the point where it was actually on page one. When you did a search for 9/11 and Pentagon, it was on page one of Google, which is pretty significant. Yeah, and I had like 250,000 hits on that article alone. And, you know, three or four months ago, I was still getting like 150 hits a day on the article, which is pretty good for a almost seven-year-old article.
Yeah.
And now it's like 30. So it's dropped, you know, by about 80%. So and I did a little search for where it showed up, and it used to be on page one. Now it's not even on page. It's not even in the first 10 pages. Yeah. And I checked Bing just to see if Bing was better, and it was on page 30 of Bing. So Bing was not better.
Yeah.
But DuckDuckGo was a lot better.
But then I understand that the censorship is due to a coalition of mainstream media entities and their allies. That so whatever carrier that you found that would kind of get you from under the full aegis of Google, they would probably be under heavy pressure to censor or let themselves be censored too, I would think.
Frank, here, can I do it then?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. There is a whole industry and a massive body of work about what's called website optimization. I know this because my son was working in that area.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of that is the way that you create the website will guarantee that you, not guarantee, but will up your chances of being on the first, second, or third page or whatever by the way you've constructed the website, things that you put in it. And what I'm saying is I'm not looking at any panacea or instant answer, but I think is that anything that's created by humans to block stuff can be can be disabled by other humans that know what they're looking for. So this can turn into a cyber war, and that's what it may really, I think, boil down to, that the people are going to figure out that are being blocked from getting to those websites, ways of reconstituting their websites that's going to fool the blockages that they put in. So I think that's the way it's going to go. Again, that's something that's going to work its way forward as we go into the future.
Well, I actually have worked in that area myself mainly as a content writer. So I'm certainly not an expert in the coding part of it, but I have some idea of how search engine optimization works. And the only thing that stops me from kind of going in that direction is just I don't have the money, you know. And I know that it's not cheap to get that done professionally, get your website optimized. Maybe it's becoming cheaper, as you know, with time. I don't know.
The problem with that approach is that Google is now employing a number of what would you call it, analysts who are actually looking at specific websites and determining whether or not they qualify as accurate, reasonably accurate, or off base. And then rating them, allowing that to be part of their rating. So it's not going to help a lot. You can fool the robots when they come to your website, but you're not going to fool these people. Okay, they're going to look and see what's there actually. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I would like to add this too. Okay, I can't help but think back to the anti-war movement, the Vietnam anti-war movement, and. Well, the media were failing us there. I mean, we created alternative media that were fairly effective and became fairly popular. And in some way, shape, or form, I think we may have to be moving towards an alternative internet of sorts that, mm-hmm. Definitely does away with all this censorship crap and just, lets people do what the internet was doing in the first place. And I think if that could be popular, I think there's a potential there. Then who knows? But I James Corbett sometimes speaks to these questions of how to create alternatives to the mainstream. But I'd also like to add this, that I was just struck living here in Houston, okay, in the middle of all this disaster, how incredibly competent, transparent, informative was our local media, Channel 13 in particular, which is what I was glued to, in keeping people up to date and we were right in touch with everything, okay? There was absolutely nothing. There was no other agenda there except to keep people informed. And it's just so sad that this mega potential that the media has is all lavished on local stuff, okay?
Yeah.
They don't spend a penny on national or international stuff. They leave it to the networks, and networks, of course, as we know, are under total control.
Yeah. I think that this might be an issue that could really unite people in this country around this. It's happening on all sides of the political spectrum. So in that sense, mm-hmm. would be a good thing to focus on. And if we don't, we're really screwed. So I think we need to figure out a way. I think it's some kind of a boycott of Google would be a good place to start.
I think so, Cheryl. I think we need to try to start a boycott Google movement and just see what happens. And if Google gets enough negative feedback that way, they'll get scared. They'll look at their bottom line and go, oops, maybe we need to rethink.
Yeah. Right. Otherwise, they're going to just walk all over us forever if we don't.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah. I had a question also like YouTube. There are other services besides YouTube, right? Like I know one is, I think, Vimeo. Does anyone know, are those as good? Or?
Yes. James Corbett is pushing BitChute, BitChute, and that's where he now posts his shows.
BitChute.
And that seems to be an alternative. And they have an interesting gimmick there where you... once you subscribe to their channel, which I think you have to do in order to watch the videos there, then you get to vote. You get to vote on what you like, and those votes determine ratings that show how high things go in being recommended to watch.
Hmm. That's good to know. Thanks.
But it's still nascent, okay? It's still it's still fairly new, but. Seems to be pretty, square.
So it's a lot of educating people to shift, have them shift over to these other sources, I guess.
I guess. That's what your opinion is. There's nothing else to do right now.
I think we should continue as a teleconference to follow this issue.
Agreed.
Keep on top of it, and
remind me if I forget, but we'll put it down in our list of issues that can be updated at any time. Okay, when we have time to do updates and so forth. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. If there's an objection, then let's move on then to our last item. That would be the proposed guideline for agenda items. And Cheryl, would you please take the facilitation role so that I can advocate my proposal?
Sure. Okay. So we're looking at the proposal that no individual participant may present on the same general subject more than twice in one calendar year without advance approval of the teleconference. And this is Ken and Craig are going to be presenting on that, so if you guys would present your case on this.
Sure. Do you want me to go, Craig, or would you like to go? I'm ready to go if you'd like me to.
No, you go ahead. You go ahead.
Okay. All right. So the situation is this. I'm getting some complaints from folks that say, we really need to limit the number of times a particular individual, makes presentations because it shouldn't be, the same person week after week or month after month and so forth. And I say, well, yeah, maybe, but I can't do that myself. I'm just a facilitator. And as a facilitator, I have always just, looked at the issue, and if it's within our ages, I put it on the agenda. I don't ask questions. So this is something that needs to be decided as a group, okay? And so that's why I put it on the agenda. And the way Craig and I formulated this proposal is I think it's open-ended and fair, although in deference to Craig, I think I would offer a friendly amendment to change the number 2 to the number 3 if nobody objects, so that it's more than 3 rather than more than 2. And also the word of at the end there be changed to by the teleconference. So those are like Scrivener type errors. But if nobody objects, I'd like to make those 2 minor adjustments in the proposal. And so what it basically says, assuming that nobody objects to those changes, is after 3 times of presenting in the same general subject area, a person just needs to make sure that the teleconference wants them to present a 4th time. That's really all it amounts to. And that way, you know, we're democratically determining the use of our space in a way that's fair for everybody. So I would appreciate it if we could establish a clear guideline, and that way, we'd have it there in front of us. I could say to someone, I'm sorry, you've already exhausted your limit. I can't grant you this permission right now, but if you take it to the teleconference, you get permission from them, and that will handle everything. So I would be very grateful if we could pass this. Craig, you want to add anything real quick?
Well, that pretty much covers it. I mean, I guess some people might sort of say, well, what do you mean by the same general subject? And that's kind of, I guess, broad, for a reason, I suppose. But, I think if we have, something happening, every second month on the same subject by the same person, then it can really imbalance things, I guess, in terms of the types of things that we look at and the type of people who present. So, yeah, so I have nothing beyond that to really add to what Ken said. I agree with all of it.
And I have a question here. A question?
Yeah, sure. Okay,
well,
are we going to vote on the amendment, which is okay?
No, I've got a question first.
Great.
Okay, let's say you have a group of people, 3-4 people, that are pretty hot on a particular topic, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. So if you have 4 people, first person does three months in a row, the next person does 3, and you end up with the same topic being there by this group of people over the year. So is it the topic or is it the person?
Well,
I'm not sure I understood the question. Did you understand it, Craig?
Well, I think I understood it. I mean, I think it's it would really require a real plan being made by a group in order to deliberately kind of skirt the rules, which I don't know if that's likely to happen or not, but I think it's the person and the topic put together.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if a different person following month wants to
mm-hmm.
present something on a similar topic, you can't really say no to them after the first person's presented. So
I don't
know how you get around that scenario you've just described.
Yeah, every person has their own quota, okay? It's an individual quota.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions, or does anyone have anything to speak against, want to speak against this motion?
This is Wayne. This is the motion on the floor is 3 times on the year, which I don't have a problem with. Over.
Okay. Anyone else? Does anyone want to speak against this motion? Okay, then hearing no opposing, then the motion will be considered approved.
Okay.
And I guess we're done with that then.
Okay, well, thank you everybody. I think we're ready for announcements.
Question. I'm curious. You had a motion that said 3 times. Are we supposed
mm-hmm.
to vote on that and then the overall motion?
Yes. I'm sorry, Wayne. I meant to address that. I meant to advise Cheryl on that. The way we've done this on the teleconference in the past is if there's a friendly amendment and there's no objection to it, it's just automatic. Okay. Friendly amendments meaning that the people proposing the amendment accept it. Okay. And if nobody objects to that amendment, then it's changed. Okay.
So does anyone object to it? Knowing a little additional piece.
Well, it's Wayne. I got one clarifying question. As Ken and you probably all know, Ken and Craig and Cheryl, I've requested time on the September. To go through the questions that Craig has asked related to where were the engines and the plane as it approached and impacted the wall. I intend to – that's on the agenda, I think. I've requested time. Will that be affected by this motion? October.
No, my opinion would be yes, it would. You would need to ask this teleconference for permission to present it on the September teleconference.
So when do I get to request that I get to ask do that, or is this a rolling beginning today from three presentations from now? It's an issue, or three past presentations, which doesn't seem to be appropriate.
No, it would simply apply to any calendar year, including this one. Okay, so the question of when to make that request is, like, you can do that at any time, and if you don't find an opportunity in the course of the teleconference, then you do it during announcements. Okay, that's announcements are like a catch-all. So you just do it there. You say, next month I'd like to present this. Does anyone object? You know, and then we'll find out. Okay.
And then we'll have a vote on it, right?
Yeah. If there's an objection, we will. If there's no objection, then there's no need to take a vote. Okay.
I guess I just thought that we would be, that people would be making the request at the beginning of the call that they wanted, where they wanted to make the presentation, if they were past.
No, Craig, come on, we can't do that. If we have a full agenda, how would that work?
It has to be done the month before, yeah.
It has to be done the month before.
But if you do it in the announcements at the end of a call, when, you know, mm-hmm. you've lost a few people over the course of the call, then, you know, you could have a very small number of people.
Well, I would agree that it would be better to do it earlier, but if you can't, then you do it then. I mean, what, you know, as long as you do it and you get to talk about disapproval, that's all that matters, okay?
Well, why don't we do it at the beginning of a call?
I don't understand, Craig. Are you suggesting making
why don't, why don't you guys talk about that off? We can figure that out later when we do it.
Then we can't vote on this.
Sure. Yeah. The principle, the implementation is something we might have to work out as a team. Okay. But you know, the principle is established. Is what we're voting on here. We just need the guideline.
So let me just simply tell you, since I believe I am the target of this particular the focus of this, I have a presentation to answer some of Craig's questions, a few other related topics to the approach. And that is probably one of my final presentations that I'm envisioning making. The only other one that could possibly be brought up is an April Gallup one that I'm envisioning, because her story is so convoluted. And, in fact, people like Bill Veal don't even know what room she was in, where her room was.
Wait, we don't have time for all these details. If you want to make a presentation, just ask the teleconference. Just say, I'd like to make this presentation next month, and here's what it's about, and then we'll you know, the teleconference can decide, okay? I mean, make it simple, please. We need to you know, cut this short.
No, you don't need to cut it short. You need to get it right. And so the question is, as I understand it, that in this calendar year 2017, no more than three presentations, which means that unless I get a special dispensation, I cannot mm-hmm. make a presentation in September related to the questions that Craig raised at my April presentation, right?
That's correct.
So I will be begging and pleading with you folks to allow me to make a presentation.
Well, are you doing it now? Is that what you're doing?
I'm going to raise it at the. If we vote on this, then my next choice is to ask for a vote for time on the September conference to review the questions that Craig had raised. Well,
so we should just vote on that then. Let's just vote on
it. Yeah, I think it's reasonable under the circumstances that that Wayne should be allowed to do that right now. That's only reasonable. So, okay. Does anybody have an objection? Oh, come on, Wayne. What?
I have an objection.
Tell me what the question
Hello?
Is. What are we voting on?
Huh?
Are we voting on three within the calendar year? Over.
No, sir. No. That's been done. Cheryl was the facilitator at the time, and she determined that there was unanimous support for it. So that part's been done, okay?
No, we haven't voted on that.
Yeah.
We voted on my sovereignty amendment.
There was no...
Cheryl?
Wayne, there was no need for a vote because there was nobody opposed it. So we didn't vote. It just said that nobody opposed it.
I'm sorry. The only thing that I heard was that there was a... Was there a request? Or there was a motion that Ken made, which was to say allow three, and then there was some other some words. We haven't yet heard the final verdict.
Right, Wayne, and then
the amendment was okay. Now the question is, I didn't hear anything. I'm sorry.
I think there is a slight issue here because. You did ask if anybody wants to speak against it, but you did not ask if anybody was opposed, okay? So under those circumstances, I think if Wayne would like us to vote on it, maybe we should take a formal vote. So I'm going to return the facilitatorship to you. Okay?
Okay.
Now I'm going to ask you to please read the motion in its entirety.
Okay. So I will right now, and then we will vote on it, correct? So no individual participant may present on the same general subject more than three times in one calendar year without advance approval by the teleconference. Okay, so that's it. So all people in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. All opposing that?
Aye.
Say nay?
Aye.
Okay. So it sounds like the ayes win. Do we want to take a voice, a name roll call?
No, the ayes clearly had it. There were only two votes against.
Okay.
I didn't hear a single nay. Did anybody say nay?
I'm sorry, but I'm opposed.
Yes, I'm opposed.
Okay, so there's one negative vote. Okay.
There's two negative.
Okay, fine. Two.
Okay, so that means...
Okay, so the eyes have it. The eyes have it, okay.
The eyes have it, so, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, Wayne, if you'd like to, again, make the proposal, we can vote on your proposal to present again next month. We can do that now if you'd like.
Okay, I'd like to make a motion to make a presentation at the September teleconference on the impact, the plane location, into the side of the Pentagon other issues related to its approach.
Okay. Are there any objections to Wayne making a presentation next month on that subject?
Yes.
Okay. There is an objection, therefore there will be debate. Therefore, we will give Wayne a minute just to explain why he wants to make this presentation, and then we will listen to others who may wish to differ. Go ahead, Wayne.
Well, I think it's really important to answer Craig's questions, which I thought were very good. He asked the question, where would the plane have been located? Where would the engine have been if the plane actually did impact the side of the Pentagon building? This is, of course, the Pentagon is the thing that has been the most dysfunctional piece of the 9/11 truth movement. And as I've been showing over the last last couple of years, at about three, possibly four presentations a year on the issues, I've basically shown that the large plane impact is a very, 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 very viable explanation for the damage. Craig raised some questions, and I need some time to answer them. It's a complicated question regarding how the plane could have swung by and not been destroyed by G-forces, how it might have gone past the generator trailer, the wire spools, and the impacted the. Right, so these are all important questions, and I think they need to be answered so that Craig can see the reasonableness of the explanations. Over.
Ken, can I say, unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave the call in about 3 minutes, unfortunately, but I'd like to at least make my point before it's too late.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not saying never, ever again in terms of my own support. I just don't really want to see this again like a second month in a row. And so I would be against it for September. It seems to be all up about answering my questions, which I'm going to look at that presentation and see if it really is just specifically directed at things I raised. That would surprise me, but nevertheless, I just think it's too much. It's too many in one. It's too many. It's got to be more than three or four in a year. I think it's more than that. Anyway, so I think we need a break from it. It doesn't have to be back-to-back months.
I would accept October.
Well, wait a minute. I'm sorry, Wayne. Did you want to amend your proposal?
If Craig has a real problem with this, pushing it back to October because he doesn't want back-to-back months, I would say that I can live with that.
We're in a formal process right now. Do you want to amend your proposal?
I will amend my motion to say October. Over.
Thank you. Okay, so the proposal is, if there's no objection, Wayne has made a friendly amendment to his own proposal to present in October. Is there any objection to allowing Wayne to make that amendment? Okay, hearing none, the current proposal is that Wayne presents in October. Is there any objection to Wayne presenting in October?
May I raise an issue? I've sort of stepped in it in a sense here that I've suggested this, so I can't really object to it now, in all good conscience. But are we saying that one can make a motion to make a presentation months in advance? Like we can do this more than a month in advance? Is that something we're going to allow? Like what if I said I want to do something in January? Would that be?
Well,
I think that's okay.
Why wouldn't that be okay, Craig? I mean, we do that a lot. We schedule things well in advance.
That's only if you're at the limit. You can schedule in advance, of course. But what we're talking about here is exceeding the limit that we've just set.
Right.
But we're only talking about the type of presentation that actually requires a vote,
you wouldn't need permission to do it. To do it in January because that'd be a new calendar year, okay?
Well, okay.
But anyway,
all right.
Fine. Okay. So the current proposal as stands is for Wayne to present this in October. Is there any objection to Wayne presenting in October? Hearing none. Is anybody opposed to Wayne presenting in October? There being no objection, Wayne will present. We will schedule Wayne for October for this presentation to answer Craig's questions. Okay, so let's move on. Announcements.
It's not an announcement per se. This is Ibrahim Saudi, the structural engineer who just joined the call for the first time. I feel deeply, actually, about coming work or presentation and conference and so on that Richard Gage is putting together, starting by the professor from Fairbanks, University of Alaska, Fairbanks, about World Trade Center 7. And I want to suggest to everybody, and I hope Richard is still on the call.
And no, he's not. Richard is no longer on the call. No.
Oh, okay, but I would like to suggest to everybody, Noam Chomsky was the one who attacked actually the 9/11 Truth Movement in the University of Florida, I think, Southern Florida or something like that, and said, if you guys discover something about the official story and you are engineers, all what you need to do is to go to our university and have them have study. And to architects and the engineers' credit, they actually raised the money and they have the study done. We should put Chomsky on the spot and kind of shame him that he should use his international fame now, since we did the study, that he should, he doesn't have to become a 9/11 truther, but he should at least publicize the study coming out of the University of Alaska as part of...
Ibrahim, I'm going to have to cut you off a little bit. I do welcome you to the teleconference, but the announcements are simply for announcing events that are planned, things that people need to be informed about, okay? But your suggestions are certainly reasonable, and if you'd like to schedule a presentation on the subject for a future teleconference, you're welcome to do that, and perhaps we could engage in a discussion on the teleconference in that direction, okay? But that's different from an announcement, okay? That's just an idea, okay? Does anybody have an announcement?
So this is Wayne. While this is not an event, I do want to mention that on our website, 911tap.org, there are two articles now. One talks about the links between 9/11 and the North Korea, and it has effectively to do with the reason that North Korea has nuclear weapons now is that in the, after 9/11, the Bush administration called them the Axis of Evil, along with Iran and Iraq, and abrogated all their all the agreements that had been worked on, and they restarted their they withdrew from the nuclear non-proliferation treaty and restarted the reactor, their plutonium reactor. There's another article that talks about how Trump is rallying the 9/11 troops by effectively calling out Afghanistan for causing 9/11. And in fact, we've posted many of the points raised by David Ray Griffin about how the war in Afghanistan is a fabrication. So I encourage you to go take a look at those two articles. There are our most two recent ones. Over.
Thank you, Wayne. I just learned recently that there's a humongous amount of mineral wealth underneath North Korea's soil, which is probably not coincidental. Okay, so who else has an announcement?
James, I guess I should announce that my group, 9/11 Truth of Central Iowa, is making a Herculean effort to keep on meeting monthly, and even though our attendance has declined precipitously, we are on the upswing a little bit again, and I want to encourage people that are leading or part of the local group to continue and continue your efforts. And also, we have a special event coming that will be on September 11th for the 10th straight year. We have rented the Varsity Theater in Des Moines, Iowa, and publicized a free film showing for the public. And, you know, this has been a success. Every year that we've been a group, this will be our 10th year of doing it. So I'm proud of that.
Okay, thank you. Any other announcements? Okay, well, that sounds like we're going to call it a night then, and we'll see you all in September. Hope all of you have something to do on September the 11th, and see you then.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Ken and Craig, can you stay on the line for a moment?
Yes. Be sure to turn the recorder off.
Okay.
Sure.